Latency is a peculiar category within the realm of ontology. If ontology can, in a very abstract manner, be defined as a discourse on being, on that which is, or on that which is said to be, or on that which ontology says it is, what is the being of what is latent? Or more precisely asked, in what sense can one speak of a being of latency itself? Not of something that is qualified as being latent, but how to determine, how to think at all and conceive of a being of latency. Why one is here dealing with a peculiar category becomes easily intelligible, because one encounters a certain conceptual recursive loop. If one seeks to determine the being of latency, one methodological temptation might be, if possible, to come up with a solid and consistent conception of being, and that very conception would then necessarily, if it is a truly consistent conception, also be robust, inclusive enough to account for the being of latency. The being of latency could in this case be either derived and inferred from the concept of being one has expounded, or it would present a particular, not necessarily peculiar, case of being. Yet, and here, the recursive loop occurs. If this is done, one peculiarly loses what one wanted to think, namely the being of latency. Why? Because weirdly, if there is a being of latency, it can be determined from within an established concept of being, this would lead to the consequence that there is no being of latency. Latency would be derivative, a secondary concept being the primary, and thereby latency would be drawn into the presence of the concept of being without any latency left. Latency on the level of being would not be latent, and hence the being of latency is at the same time the very abolishment or negation of the being of latency. In short, if one proceeds like this from a unified, rigid concept of being to the being of latency, there is no latency, precisely due to the attempt to think the being of latency. One could react to this problem in a threefold manner. First, one could infer that latency is simply not an ontological category, or something that is linked, can be related to, plays a role in, irritates, etc., ontology at all, but is rather an ontic category. Then one can still speak of latency, inscribed into history, material and physical settings, into concrete situations, constellations, etc. Second, one could argue that precisely the peculiar effect that occurs in trying to determine the being of latency is how latency, how to say, appears, emerges, withdraws, shies away in ontology. This would amount to saying that thinking the being of latency is precisely in its failure how latency can only be thought, namely as that which decreases and reduces the encompassing and inclusive power of any concept, no matter how consistent of being itself. And hence, it is what splits being from within into two, maybe even into many. This option would imply that there is a latency of being, something in being that is not of being. That precisely occurs, maybe not only then, due to the peculiar effect that results from seeking to think the being of latency and failing with it. Or finally, the third option, one could make a similar move as I just depicted with regard to the second, but with a different emphasis and outcome. One would then seek to argue that to think the being of latency and failing with it does not only lead us to the idea that there is a latency of being, but rather allows for a further inference, and maybe even more fundamental one. Thinking the being of latency and ending up where one ends up is to comprehend more, not of latency, but of being. In short, what if, the third option could argue, being is latency, and hence thinking the being of latency is an attempt to think being. So what the hell to do with this peculiar panorama? In what follows, I will proceed in the following manner. I will first deal with one proposal of how to conceptualize latency within ontology, will secondly trace some conceptual and loosely genealogical implications of this proposal, and will thirdly and finally try to formulate a proposal that I can link, I hope somehow nicely, to the title of this conference. Because I want to argue that one should move from the idea of linking latency and the possible to the idea of latencies of the possible within the realm of ontology, and thereby would like to suggest, so I read it as a move from one to the other, and thereby would like to suggest that the category or concept of latency should be linked to the category of what's latent in the possible, namely the impossible. Okay, first bit. One of the certainly most famous thinkers of latency, namely Ernst Bloch, we heard already something about him, formulated in his last published work, Experimentum Mundi, a far-reaching thesis about how to locate latency within ontology. To perform this localization of latency, Bloch initially differentiates, but also relates latency to the concept of tendency, as Dobermankowski already mentioned that. So what is a tendency? Tendency can, for him, firstly be characterized as the opposite of what is lawful. Because the law, I quote Bloch, fixes that which repeats, tendency leaves a space open for the novel, unquote. So tendency is that which leaves open, hence creates a space of the open, and it's precisely within this open that not only the new, but also latency is situated. Tendency is that which breaks with, interrupts, suspends, lawful repetition, and through this rupture, and through this rupture alone, one can grasp what is latent in the tendency. Already in his much earlier Spirit of Utopia, Bloch stated that latency is what is, I quote, waiting in the head of everything, the inconstruable question of its thing in itself. This is, in other words, which is not yet, unquote. Latency names an inconstruable question and thereby names the thing in itself, which as such did not yet realize itself within the realm of existence. How to unpack this? In a first answer, one may say that latency corresponds to the noumenal in Kant, but not as such. It is not the thing in itself already itself, but is rather the noumenal which shines through. This is what Bloch calls in German Vorschein, and he wrote a whole aesthetics on that. So the noumenal shines through within the phenomenal sphere as something which is not yet what it is supposed to be. This is why it takes the form of a question, because we don't know what it is supposed to be. In other words, there's only latency because things are not yet the way they're supposed to be, but it's completely unclear how they're supposed to be. This is why there's latency. This is why latency can only be grasped via the interruption of lawfulness, i.e., the way things are, i.e., through tendency as that which asserts itself as a not yet existent direction of all things. In other words, to think latency, one needs the form of an interruption of lawful repetition, tendency, and then one can grasp a previously not yet thought, maybe yet not yet thinkable direction, purpose, or aim of this very tendency. Latency is the telos that can only be grasped from a break within the existing realm of things and thought as that which retroactively even grounds this very break. So this is the point, right? It retroactively grounds the break from which it occurs. Latency, thus, is the ground for something akin to what Deleuze once called a finality without aim, finality sans fin. A teleology, i.e. a theory of why things strive into a certain direction, whose telos somehow remains hidden simply because it's not yet realized. Thereby, one might say that tendency, rupture with the law, is linked to the realm of possibility. Possible breaks with the law, with repetition. Latency, then, is that which retroactively can be understood as the ground of this very break, only after the break already occurred. It is thus not simply possible in the same sense. Latency in different terms is what makes possible breaks possible. It is the ground of possibility for Bloch. It is what stands in the heart of that which is not lawful, i.e., in the heart of that which breaks the heart of the law. What is latent is thereby not transcendent, but rather fully immanent. In the tendencies that do or seek to break the law, but one can only think it as a consequence of the rupture with the law. What emerges there is what Bloch calls the first and the last question, unquote. But why is this question an ontological one? Simply because tendencies manifest themselves concretely and in a historical specific manner, tendencies temporal, whereas latency is extemporal, transtemporal for Bloch. It is what, I quote, grounds, trägt, substance, or the truly good end, Zweck. Latency is what grounds the being of everything, even including being, this is Bloch's thesis in Experimentum Mundi, to strive towards something that can only be thought if there is a break with what is. And this also means with what is considered to be being. A very strange version of Aristotelianism. But as latency is the cause for anything, even being to strive for something, latency is that wherein, quote, any tendency has the strange pre-existence of its direction and its anticipation, unquote. Bloch, to back up his claim, refers to Marx's Capital, in which, as he remarks, latency does not receive a categorical place because it is in some sense and at the same time what grounds the whole Marxian endeavor. Yet, there is also a reason why it does not receive a categorical place, namely because it smells of, I quote Bloch, a last bit of the old heavens, of the already constructed heaven of the beyond, unquote, and therefore seems to be, quote again, too easily misused, unquote, for a materialist like Marx. In short, Marx's resistance to what the category of latency is explained by Bloch by stating that for him there is a danger of identifying latency with a hidden reason or a cunning of reason that lurks at the back of history. For if latency is supposed to ground the movement of that which is not yet, there is a danger of identifying this not yet, of the question of direction, with an always already given answer to this question. In short, with a new transcendental or theological law. The break of the law then would simply be nothing but the manifestation of another kind of superior law. So Marx does not use the term latency for sort of strategic reasons. I mean, this is Bloch, right? Namely, to avoid establishing a proto-theological law of how the revolutionary new enters the world. One simple question, is this really the case? In Marx's Capital, namely in volume 2, where he speaks of the process of circulation of capital, and more precisely of what he calls simple reproduction, Marx employs the term latency. He uses the term when he speaks of latent money capital. With this, he means deposits in banks, state funds, stocks, and similar things that somehow function like money, as that which makes exchange possible as universal equivalent, but somehow also function like capital, that is in some sense of making money, money that produces more money, or in short, surplus. Frederick Engels, but they're withdrawn from the sphere of circulation, right? This is the point. Frederick Engels inserted an editorial footnote to this term in which he explains the use of the term in the following manner. I quote, "The expression latent is borrowed from theories of latent heat. Engels furthermore claims that the expression latent money capital is synonymous, I quote again, to potential capital borrowed from the conception of potential energy and functions analogously to D'Alembert's virtual velocities," unquote. Interesting references, right? And just the theory or the series, latency, potentiality, virtuality. So what is the physical theory of latent heat? It seeks to explain the heat quantity that is either spent or generated in transformations of aggregate states, but which at the same time is not objectively measurable in terms of a difference of temperature. This is what I found, I don't get that. This is due to the fact, so this theory goes, there is no measure of how to measure this kind of heat, because this heat does not objectively appear. And I think it becomes more understandable if we take a look at Marx again. because an analogous transformation is at play in the logic that Marx depicts when he speaks of latent money capital. When the accumulated surplus turns into treasure, as Marx says, it does not float any longer within the sphere of circulation and hence cannot that easily be measured. Think of, I don't know, the 30 millions Mitt Romney is supposed to have in the Cayman Islands, right, in cash. So that would be latent money capital, I think, for Marx. So the transformation from surplus into latent money capital names an inner transformation, a transformation that is an extraction from the sphere of circulation and use, but does not transform the objective value of the latent money capital with regard to the surplus it represents. The 30 million in cash are still 30 million, right? I mean, this doesn't change, but they're somehow withdrawn from the sphere of circulation. Latency, thus, in Marx, names a transformation of form, which does not appear in the external sphere of measurability, a transformation that does not transform the value, but something else. Nonetheless, the series of concepts are interesting, right? And so what to do with this, again? Maybe unsurprisingly, one can find a discussion of the theory of latent heat in Hegel's Encyclopedia of Philosophical Sciences, namely in volume 2. Hegel is completely and utterly hostile towards the idea that chemical elements persist in their identity within new compounds. He rather argues that elements temporarily resolute into new forms of unity. assuming elements, chemical elements in this case, can be accounted for as separately existing substances is for him nothing but a naive, better, super metaphysical claim. And his unremitting hostility is directed against the substantialism or atomism that he sees there. The idea that heat that is not objectively present and cannot be measured can nonetheless be addressed as existent heat is simply contradictory for him. This contradiction springs from the frame in which the theories of latent heat necessarily have to situate themselves, namely within the laws of existence, within the laws of objectivity and measurability. For the sphere of existence, for Hegel, is there, I quote, the sphere of being for others, of making oneself noticeable, unquote. And what is not noticeable simply does not exist within the sphere of existence. To contend the existence of a latent heat means that there is a heat that although doesn't make itself noticeable. This is for him nothing but the expression of a desperate attempt to retain the identity of a thing that already changed, something like a melancholic physical fetishism that is unable to let go of something that is already lost. This motivates Hegel's very polemical question that sums up his attack and which I stole for my title, namely, how can something be present which yet does not exist? So, physics is not ontology, obviously. And what does not hold for the physical sphere may hold for the ontological one, even in Hegel, as I would like to argue. What does this mean? It means that one could consider the Hegelian enterprise as one gigantic attempt of coming to terms, I mean, this is my claim, of coming to terms with latency within ontology, of answering the question of what it means for something to be there which yet does not exist, of thinking that which is latent in being itself. One can thereby modify Hegel's polemical question for the realm of ontology in the following way. How can there be something, whatever, which is not, maybe which is not yet? And that I take this to be one of the most important Hegelian questions. It's ultimately a question of how to understand, I think, non-being. So against all criticisms of Hegel being the super narcissistic, all-encompassing incorporator of everything into a stable system that is stable precisely because of its dynamic constitution, I would like to suggest a different take on Hegel. I would this argue that the philosopher of actuality and actualization and of their necessity should rather be read as a theoretician, as a thinker of latency. Therefore, I think one should turn to the science of logic, the manifestation of Hegel's project, which in the classical renderings of it has always been read as presenting his objective, at least in the first part, objective ontology. The science of logic is itself one of a quite strange and most peculiar, one of the most peculiar objects in the history of philosophy. Its strangeness did provoke the great Hegelian Theodor Adorno to once state the following, I quote, "In the realm of great philosophy, Hegel is no doubt the only one with whom, at times, one literally does not know and cannot conclusively determine what is being talked about, and with whom there is no guarantee that such a judgment is even possible." Quite nice, right? Unquote. A lot of things seem to be latent here. Hegel's logic, as Adorno therefore accentuates, I quote again, resists understanding, unquote, more than any other text of Hegel, but also more than any other text that can be found in the history of philosophy. One reason for this might already come to the fore if one takes into account one of the infamous and allegedly the most immodest of them all claims that can be found in its introduction. He there elaborates at one point that the pure science, the science of pure thought, which the science of logic is about to present, has as its sole matter nothing but pure thought. Pure thought, it is because after the proceedings of the phenomenology of spirit, the thought with which Hegel is dealing in the logic, I quote, has sublated all references to an other and to mediation, unquote. One is here thus no longer dealing with any form of phenomenal consciousness or with the depiction of its structure, internal constitution, contradictory nature, etc. Thought is, let's say, alone. It has no longer, and at the same time not yet, any relation to an other. Where is one now? I mean, this is, I think, a very trivial but fundamental question. Where is that? Where does that take place? Where is one after the phenomenology? A problematic answer would be in the realm of the noumenal, because Hegel has already shown in the phenomenology how it needs, how even the phenomenology itself needs to contain what Jean Hippolyte once called a noumenology, when he speaks about religion and, of course, about the sphere of absolute knowing. Not only does the phenomenology present a process of the vanishing of all determinations, mediations, and so forth, in its very end, it depicts why even the vanishing of the process of vanishing is absolutely necessary, such that we do not take this process of vanishing as a last sort of stability. So where are we even left? So where are we when we even left the noumenal sphere behind and are in thought's purity? I want to argue we're in the realm of latency. This is why it becomes a true question, what does it mean to present pure thought, to present the realm of thought in which thought thinks nothing but thought itself? After the vanishing of the process of vanishing of all determinations, phenomenology, one is left with less than nothing. There is not even nothing left. There is no being and no nothing yet. I mean, this is what the logic begins, right? So we don't have them yet. And it's important that there is also no I of an I thing still involved. About thought, one seems to only be able to say it thinks. And it's precisely here that Hegel lets the peculiar cat out of the speculative bag. Because the ultimate exposition of thought in its purity will be, I quote, this is the immodest claim I refer to, the exposition of God as he is in his eternal essence before the creation of nature and the finite mind, unquote. Reading the signs of logic is to read the mind of God before he created the world. I mean, I take this nuts to be the expression of a megalomaniac madman. Hegel has arguments, mostly. For he tries to argue that first, if the logic is really delivering what it promises, although it could be better done, he says, this is because it presents everything that belongs to pure thought, thought as such, and not just the thought of a peculiar someone thinking a peculiar something. It is the complete exposition of thought thinking thought. And second, if God has thought before he created the world, and before he created the particular thought of finite minds, he or she or it must also have obeyed the same laws, must have used, I quote, the necessary forms and self-determinations of thought, unquote, that any thought has to rely on. So if God thought, he had to follow these laws that he then afterwards... No, you see, things get difficult here. So in this sense, what Hegel is proposing is that the science of logic is unfolding the realm of thought before the creation of concrete thought. In short, that which is not yet, but nonetheless is. Hence a systematic exposition of latency. However, today such a claim might indeed seem immodest. I mean, just consider the majority of people, I think, working in philosophy, even on Hegel, are highly metaphysical or theological. But leaving all types of external criticisms aside, the mentioned claim also delineates the proper strangeness of the science of logic. In some sense, thought is that which is latently there, before it exists. In some sense, thought is its own anticipation. And if this book exposes the essence of God before the creation of nature and finite minds, it also enables one to think the very moment of creation of nature and finite minds. We hence also get to think that which in Bloch's terminology makes tendency into a tendency, a break. Right? But here things get complicated, and right now, really speculative. I'm sorry for that. Why? As Hegel once argued in his late lectures on logic, I quote, the answer is that when we first have hold of the infinite, we have it alone, much as God before the creation of the world is alone. Yet when we have the infinite alone, it is the bad infinite, just as God is not the true God if he does not manifest himself outwardly. For God is only God in the act of creating the world, unquote. As soon as one achieves the standpoint of God before the creation of the world, it becomes clear that God before the creation is not yet truly God. For to become who he is, he needs to create. This means if we can think what God thought before he created, we can also think what he thought when he created and decipher why he had to create. God before the creation can only be thought when he already created. namely the thought that thinks what he thought before he created. Otherwise, he simply would not be God, and there would not be such a thought. His creation is in this sense also self-creation. To think God before the creation is only possible when his act of creation is taken into account. He is that which can only be thought as being prior to the creation, when at the same time it is understood that he is retroactive, retrocreative effect of his own creation. This is Hegel's point, I think. What Hegel already with this claim implies, that the logic exposes God's eternal essence only insofar as it renders clear that to think God means to conceive of him, to use this Nietzschean saying, as becoming who he is. Rendered more simply, one might say that thinking that to think God becoming God, i.e. his act of creation, that properly makes him into God, we have to think the beginning of this, his becoming, namely his act of creation. So even when one limits oneself to this argument on the level of these very abbreviated remarks, before the logic has begun, right? We're still in the introduction. One can already see that one of the most crucial, if not the one, problem that the logic addresses is the problem of beginning. But how to conceive of this problem properly? Is there a latent beginning before the beginning? I mean, the first 70 pages, Hegel is completely obsessed with beginning and failing and beginning again and raising the question of how to begin. So, it might be articulated as follows. The logic exposes God's thought, i.e. his essence before the creation of the world. Yet, this can only be done and God is only God after the creation. Thus, one needs to inscribe the act of creation into God's essence. Yet God is not simply the act of creation, but he will always have been prior to the creation, although only accessible after by means of the logic. This is to say that God will have truly become God when he created, but one should simply not confuse the act of creation with the essence of God. God is retroactively, retrocreatively, logically prior to his creation because he is the creator, but the beginning of God truly becoming God, his act of creation, and God as essentially prior to his creation should not be identified. Otherwise, one gets a Schillingian God. This is the danger, a God which could not but create. In a form of, let's say, ontological principled vitalism. So the problem of beginning is a true problem because with it occurs a peculiar parallax. And I think in this parallax, latency is located. In the beginning, there is an act of creation making God into God. However, there's also something in the beginning which is not active, creative, but static, namely God before the creation. The beginning itself, in German, there's an almost unnoticeable phonetic minimal difference between the verb anfangen and the noun anfang, is the unity of differences of creation, movement, and stasis. Why is there a parallax involved? 3 more minutes.
Okay.
Because as soon as we start thinking God prior to his creation, we see that we have to inscribe the act of creation into his essence to have an adequate comprehension of it. However, as soon as we start conceiving of God in terms of creation, we necessarily have to notice that he precedes his creation. Otherwise, we would at the same time have contradicted what we just said, what we want to think, right? Namely, God prior to the creation. After his creation, he can be thought as that which will have been prior to this creation, yet it would be wrong to simply simply infer that God's essence lies in the act of creation. Why? Because before the act of creation, God is already God. Not in and for himself, but in himself. He's not God for us, but he's God. God is God before the creation, although God will have become to be truly what he is only after the creation. His essence will have become the true essence of God before the creation, after the creation. This is to say, the essence before the creation will have been different after the creation, yet this essence is not identical with the act of creation. This is my point, right? What one thus gets in this explication is a parallax movement in which the object in view, namely God, changes depending on where one starts from, and one cannot simply get a total perspective on this object. One is driven into a circular argument. This is why the weird formulations that I use all the time. One is driven into a circular argument where one side constantly leads to the other, thereby marking the minimal difference between God's essence as static prior to the creation and dynamic, depending on the creation. I take this to be one possible account of how to locate latency, namely precisely in this minimal difference, in the gap that appears only through the peculiar logic of this Möbius strip argument. It is thus not presupposed a deeper hidden level driving the whole movement of latency, as one can still read Bloch, I think, but rather one can one can only glimpse at it, at the latency, through the movement that I just tried to depict. This is consistent, I think, with Hegel's claim that the logic begins without any presupposition. It cannot presuppose any form of reflection and laws of thinking. This is Hegel. Not even the presupposition of a peculiar latent something. That which is not, yet is nonetheless somehow there, appears through the production of a minimal difference within the movement of thought itself. Hence, there is no thought, not even God's, without latency. No thought without latent thought. And Hegel tries precisely to account for that which is latent in thought, that which true thought cannot but produce in its own movement, as that which drives it forward by constantly linking it back to something that it cannot entail, precisely because it produces it. Thought, if it is pure thought, thinking itself, cannot but necessarily generate this peculiar object that it tries to come to terms with. Yet at the same time, it is not only a necessary product of thought's activity, but also something that is impossible for thought to entail. There is never only one stance from which it could be grasped. Rather, it's only through the shift of perspective, God before the creation, God after the creation, that it occurs. Yet this necessarily produced and impossible to include object of thought is what is in the heart of thought. It is something that I would like to call a latent object of thought, maybe a latent thought in Freud's terms, of which one can say that it's absolutely necessary to think it, yet it's absolutely impossible to do so. And just to remind you, that which is at the same time impossible and necessary is for Lacan what he calls the real. It appears as the constant underside of thought, something that is accompanied by constantly, and it appears, if one may say so, only through this shift of perspective, which in visual terms would be an anamorphosis. To end, I want to contend that if one takes Hegel not to be a complete idiot, but as someone who made a vital contribution to the conceptualization of latency, I think one should draw the following consequences from this idea. Thought begins not with movement, but with a certain form of stuckness, since thought is overly attached to that which it cannot think consistently, but it cannot stop, is compelled to repeatedly attempt to think it. Somewhat like in German, one can speak of an Ohrwurm. Thought has its very own earworm without having ears, something it cannot get rid of, which drives it. And this weird object is not even nothing, it's less than nothing, but it generates this weird compulsion to repeatedly think it. Thought produces something that is not thought, something that is not, yet is there. Maybe it is a not, with K or without. It drives thought, and thought is stuck to thinking this very something, which is not a thing. It's nonetheless there. So my Hegelian proposal would be, latency is a qualification of the peculiar object of thought, which thought necessarily produces when it tries to relate to itself in purity. Yet this object, which is not an object, rather something that occurs en passant, in passing, is impossible to grasp and to think as such. Latency is thus not an ontological category, but what I would like to call a para-ontological category in Hegel's sense of the paradigm, the Beispiel, bei Herspielend. And somehow, this is the move I try to... It is, in some sense, the strip of the Möbius strip. It's neither, not two, one of the two sides. It's precisely, the strip. It names something which I think any thought, also the thought of being, is stuck on, as that which is necessary and impossible at the same time. And it's never the same, as I tried to show. In short, no thought with an event of latency. Thank you.